Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The streets of New York City are virtually empty. The city that never sleeps is silent, except for the sound of sirens and the applause, singing, and pot banging at 7 o'clock each night for healthcare workers and first responders. New York is the epicenter of this country's COVID-19 epidemic. So this hour on Point, why New York is that epicenter, what life is like there now, and what lessons the city has for other American metropolises. And we will start today in Manhattan on the Lower East Side with Anna Silman. She's senior writer at New York Magazine, and she's been writing a series called A Diary of a Hospital, and we have a link to her stories at onpointradio.org. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Hi, Meghna.
Hi. So first of all, how are you doing, and how much has life changed for you in New York?
I am doing okay. I feel very lucky to be in a home that I feel comfortable with, with my partner, my cat. I feel very privileged, but obviously it's been a huge adjustment. And I live normally in a very bustling, very lively neighborhood, and it's really strange to hear sort of silence outside, except for this constant noise of sirens. That's kind of the only thing you hear now.
Wow. I mean, it's actually kind of hard to imagine New York being quiet like that. It must be a shocking change.
It's certainly eerie, I think, is the best way to describe it.
Eerie. Okay. Well, you have been working on a series called Diary of a Hospital. And this is dispatches that medical staff at Mount Sinai in Brooklyn are sending you?
Yeah. So I've been interviewing different people on staff. So we'll have a 30-40 minute phone call, and they've been telling me about their days. And we've done 6 dispatches so far. We've spoken to the chief medical officer, the head nurse, the head of the ICU, and we're hoping to continue the project throughout the COVID crisis.
Mm. So let's just talk a little bit about the most recent dispatch, right? It was the head from Dr. Adam Brenner, who's the head of the ICU there. Can you tell us a little bit about what he's seeing? Because he's obviously having to care for the most ill patients there now.
Yeah, I mean, speaking to Dr. Brenner was really heartbreaking. They're really doing everything they can. He's working 14, 15-hour days. And he was just saying that the prognosis for the very sickest patients, the critically ill patients on ventilators, is really not good. And, of course, you're seeing older patients, but you're also seeing a lot of patients in their 50s and 60s who are kind of lingering on the ventilators and not getting better. And I think, he was feeling really disheartened by that. One line he had that really stuck with me is he said, in other diseases, we still have hope, and this has really taken away all of our hope. And that was really tough to hear.
Did he say why? Is it just because of the intensity of what he's seeing right now?
There's just no, for the patients who do have the worst outcome, there's not really anything they can do except supportive care, which means putting them on the ventilator, but there is no cure. They just have to, as I understand it, hope that, while they're on the ventilators, the virus will kind of work its way out of their system. And that's not something that they're seeing very often, unfortunately.
Yeah. And he also talked to you about what impact this is having on him. I think he told you that he's not sure what going back to normal for him will look like when we're on the other side of all of this.
Yeah. He said that it's going to be very hard to go back to work after this. I mean, he echoed something that I think a lot of the people I've spoken to have said, which is that this is very traumatizing. As doctors, you're used to saving lives, and you're used to feeling like you have a good chance of saving every patient. And I don't think that is the pervasive feeling right now. And that's very, very hard.
Now, Anna, can you tell me what impact do you think this is having or has had on New Yorkers, right? Because, I mean, this is one of the great cities of the world, and it's also uniquely American all at the same time. Like, just what impact has this had on New York?
I mean, it feels like such a cliche to say, but New Yorkers are so resilient. You know, I've lived in New York for 8 years, and in that time I've lived through, you know, I lived through Hurricane Sandy, and I saw a lot of the businesses around me live through it as well. And, you know, New Yorkers, I feel confident that we'll bounce back. But that being said, it's very, very difficult. I live in the Lower East Side, which is a really sort of bustling neighborhood, like I said, full of bars, restaurants, tons of street life, and that isn't there. And all these small businesses have been forced to shut down, many of them. You know, it's not certain how long they'll be shut down for. And I think there's real concern about, you know, whether people are going to be able to keep their businesses, keep their livelihoods.
Mm. Well, Anna Silman is a senior writer at New York Magazine. She usually writes for The Cut, covering women's fashion and health. Since this epidemic took hold, though, in New York, she has been writing a series called Diary of a Hospital, and we have a link to all of her reporting at onpointradio.org. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, yesterday, Governor Andrew Cuomo, in his daily briefing, gave the latest numbers for the daily death toll in New York State as a whole. But he also looked for the silver lining in some of those numbers.
We want to talk about a cold winter where the earth becomes barren. This has been a cold period from a societal point of view. And we've closed down in a way we've never closed down. But we will come back to life, and we will have a rebirth. And that's what spring is all about. And the rebirth is primarily about our people and about our spirit.
That's Governor Andrew Cuomo speaking yesterday in his daily briefing. Well, joining us now is Dr. Bruce Farber. He is chief of infectious diseases for the Northwell Health Hospital System. It's New York State's largest healthcare provider with 23 hospitals and close to 800 outpatient facilities. Dr. Farber, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Meghna.
So first of all, if I may ask, I think over the past couple of days, we've at least seen a plateau in the number of new hospitalizations in New York City. Is the city itself turning some kind of corner?
We hope so. I think you're right. We have seen a plateau. Unfortunately, we continue to see large numbers of patients still critically ill on ventilators because there's a lag time. Hopefully they will decrease over the next week. The critical time in this infection is between day five and day eight, when people generally deteriorate. So yes, I am cautiously optimistic, but clearly we're not out of the woods.
Mm. So at this point in time, then, what is the capacity of your hospital system, of the hospitals in New York City? Are they, I mean, they're slammed for sure, but do they have what they need to cope with even the number of patients they're seeing now?
Well, it's all relative. Yes, we certainly have enough ventilators. That's not a problem. We do have enough personal care equipment in my health system. Yes, we are overwhelmed. There are patients in areas in this hospital that we never had patients before. We've transformed lobbies into bed wards. We've transformed our cardiac units that used to be used for outpatients into inpatient units. Our children's hospital, large children's hospital, has half adults in it now. I could go through this over and over again, but every nick and corner of our hospitals are full of patients, including several tents that are up outside of our hospitals. So it's still very stressful.
I see. So, Dr. Farber, there are three goals that we'd like to accomplish this hour. One is to begin to try to learn why New York is the epicenter, at least for the time being, of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States, how New York City in particular has been coping, and then the lessons that the city has for, you know, other places, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, Houston, potential new hotspots here. So to that first question, what would be your answer for at least the beginning of our understanding of why New York has been hit so hard?
Well, I think there's lots of reasons, and some that we don't know. But one of the obvious reasons is that it's a very dense city. We've had a lot of people coming in here from all parts of the world. I mean, this is the only city that I'm aware of in the United States that used to have direct flights from Wuhan three times a week. We also have a lot of flights from Europe. And there were multiple introductions, more likely than not, into New York of this virus. So that was one thing. Second thing is, I think clearly in retrospect, that month of not having testing was a devastating time when the virus was spreading throughout the city and other parts of the country, but here clearly more so. And that caused a critical mass of infected people to develop and then spread them around. Thirdly, we were late in getting people to do this social distancing. I think, it was very difficult once the epidemic became so widespread to put it back down, which we're slowly doing at the present time. And I think without testing, doctors are terribly blind in terms of who's infected and what advice they can give. This test is critical. Remember, this was occurring during the heart of the flu epidemic, and a reasonable physician cannot distinguish COVID from flu when it first presents. So many people who probably thought to have flu back then probably had COVID. And that's when we lost, I think, critical weeks in dealing with this.
So it's a complex mix of factors here. And I'm thinking back to the first thing you said about how connected New York is to the rest of the world. Those flights directly from Wuhan in China, but then the first positively diagnosed case in New York City was from Iran, right? And I'm also reading that many of those early cases may have been from Europe as well.
Absolutely.
So it is a complex picture, and we're going to dive more into it, including what role the political response played in making New York City such a hot zone for the COVID-19 pandemic. So Dr. Farber, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about New York City, what's happening there right now regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, and the lessons that New York has for other American cities as well. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about why New York City is the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States and what lessons New York has for other American cities. And if you're listening from Greater New York, give us a call and tell us what you see and what your reality is right now and what advice you would give to Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Houston, other places that could soon become hotspots for COVID-19. Now, we did receive a voicemail from Sean. He is a former EMT. He's now working in the tech industry. He lives in Harlem, and here's what he called us to say.
Watch all the movies about, you know, bad stuff happening in a place like New York. And the assumption is like the apocalypse has come and everybody's going to run ballistic, looting stores and doing bad things. And the exact opposite has happened. My experience of this really just has to be with people being very good humans and coming together to give and share what they have. You know, a good way of seeing, you know, a good way for all of New York, not just Harlem, is really the participation in kind of the 7 o'clock applaud and support first responders. It's phenomenal.
That's Sean, who lives in Harlem. Well, joining us now is Errol Lewis. He is a political anchor at NY1 News and host of NY1's Inside City Hall. He writes a column for the New York Daily News as well. And we have a link to his work at onpointradio.org. Errol, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Magna.
So first of all, how have you been and what has it been like to watch your city go through this?
I've been better. It's a little difficult to get through this. We took what was basically a local newsroom and sent everybody home. So everybody's broadcasting from their homes, and that includes the producers and the graphics people and everybody else. So, we love to work in newsrooms so that we can sort of share things, and now we're doing pretty much the opposite at this point. This has been a very tough time. The entire city is shut down. Your favorite restaurant probably isn't open and won't deliver. Your dry cleaners is not going to reopen anytime soon, and they've got your clothes, you know, on and on and on. There are a lot of different ways in which the city has simply come to a halt.
Mm. Well, you know, you heard Dr. Farber walk us through some of the key medical and epidemiological reasons, public health reasons, why New York is suffering particularly acutely right now. Politics also plays a role here. So, Errol, can you just take us back a couple of months, say February, and remind us what were the earliest responses from Mayor de Blasio?
The earliest responses were not great, and I was interviewing people all the way through, not just the mayor every week. I have a standing appointment with him to do an interview, but also with his health commissioner, with the head of the hospitals. We have 11 public hospitals here, and I talked with Dr. Katz about all of this. Look, the city's response was a little sluggish. There's just no getting around it. I don't even think they would deny it at this point. There was conflicting information about how long the coronavirus could last, say, on a surface, like, I don't know, a subway pole. At first we were told it could only last for a couple of minutes. We later discovered that that wasn't accurate at all. We were told that we should go out and live our lives and, you know, just go about your business, try and stay away from people if it seemed like they had symptoms, but other than that, you'd be okay. That turned out to be not great advice. We learned so much about this as we went deeper and deeper into the crisis. By the time it was clear what we needed to do, meaning shut down the schools, shut down the businesses, send everybody home, socially distance everybody, close the parks and the playgrounds and so forth, it was really too far gone at that point.
Mm. Well, you mentioned Mayor de Blasio telling New Yorkers to go about their business. Here is what the mayor said on March 5th at a press conference from City Hall that day.
New Yorkers are pretty tough, pretty resilient. They're generally going about their business. Some organizations, you're absolutely right, are making choices, some travel-related changes, et cetera. But I think the best thing we can all do is remind people, keep going about your lives. You know, keep going out and patronizing those businesses. We'll tell you the second we think you should change your behavior. Again, we're constantly communicating here. But right now, go about your business.
Errol, was that sort of a putting on the face of confidence in the midst of the fog of war? I mean, because we were already getting information. We had already seen, I mean, Italy, China,
right,
obviously. So what
right.
was going on there?
That is just a mistake. That is a mistake for which the administration has to be held accountable. There's no other way to put it. That is just a mistake. Everything that they knew at the time, or had reason to know at the time, suggested that that was not the right message to give to the public. There were a number of other fights, by the way, where as it became clear that different parts of the society were going to have to be shut down or dialed back, the mayor in particular did not want to close the schools. And he agonized over it publicly, and it went on and on and on and on. And it was probably a week or two later than it should have been. And along the way, teachers got sick, principals got sick, members of the teaching staff got ill, and in a few cases there were fatalities. There's going to be an after-action study of all of this at some point. But like the clip that you just played, it's mind-boggling in a way, Because, again, we already had seen what had happened in South Korea and what had happened in Spain and what had happened in Italy. They're going to have to answer for this at some point.
You know, you're right about the after-action analysis and report. And some people might be saying now is not the time to do it. But New York's after-action is Houston's pre-action, right?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So that's why exactly right. It's worth examining this right now. So, Dr. Farber, let me ask you, from the point of view of the medical community, I mean, were there particular challenges in getting sort of the most accurate flow of information to City Hall or even to Albany in terms of Governor Cuomo? Or is this simply just the confusion that arises in the fog of war in an unprecedented global pandemic?
Well, I basically agree with everything that's been said. I would point out from the medical point of view that the most important thing and the most important lost opportunity was that lack of testing early on. And that was in the control of the federal government, not the state or the city. Because after all, we were only allowed to do COVID testing if it was sent to the CDC, and there were very, very strict criteria on who could get tested. Clearly, in retrospect, I can't imagine anyone denying that that hurt terribly. In retrospect, there were many other things. Quite frankly, our healthcare system, our society was never prepared for a pandemic like this. That's another lesson to be learned. Our surge capacities, the way we fund hospitals, the way we fund healthcares, it has to be rethought after this.
Rethought from the top, from the top to bottom?
Yes, I think that this will permanently change the approach. Yes, I think this is going to end. We will get over this. We will come back. Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to happen quickly. I think it may take a year, 2 years, 3 years until we are vaccinated or develop herd immunity. And that's going to take a very large percent of the population to have been infected. This virus will continue to be around, less severe as months go on. But it's not going to go away in the summer. We're not going to turn on a light switch and suddenly say things are back to normal. I think people want to think that, but that's not likely to happen.
You know, I keep coming to the thought that this is a natural tragedy that's been exacerbated. It's turned into a human-made disaster, right? Because it's the decisions that leaders make in the face of information both certain and uncertain that can make things better or make things worse. So, Errol Lewis, like, help us understand how much was in the hands of Mayor de Blasio versus in the hands of Governor Cuomo in terms of making decisions, those early decisions that could have been made.
Those early decisions, there are, you know, if you lay out day by day the decisions that were being made, the mayor of San Francisco, on the very same day as New York was wondering whether to close schools, San Francisco closed the schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there are other groups that were at least as well informed and who just took more decisive action for whatever reason. We have exacerbated the problems that we had here. I don't know if it was just a matter of people not quite understanding the reality that was evolving around them. If the news was so bad, they couldn't quite get their head around it. You know, we've never had anything like this as far as sending everybody home and shutting down major businesses. I didn't even understand whether there was a legal basis to do it at one point. So it was uncharted territory for a lot of people. But both the governor and the mayor and their commissioners, using let's assume it's the best information they had at the time, there was a timing question. You know, the conclusions that they reached so late that even 7 to 10 days could have made a huge difference, we now know.
Mm. You know, I keep thinking about Dr. Farber's correct observation that the lack of testing made a bad problem even worse, right? Because it's hard to deny data when you actually have it in your hands. And also just, I don't know, I'm speaking as a non-New Yorker. I mean, New York City is 8 million people. It's America's most populous city. It is, you know, a great world city. I think it would have taken perhaps I find a little forgiveness in my heart, Errol, for Mayor de Blasio, because it would have taken a lot to say, well, we don't yet have the data, but let's shut this place down.
Yeah, well, I mean, but that's what ended up happening. That's
yeah.
the thing.
True. Point.
You know, yep. And we have all of the difficulty and discomfort of a shutdown without the full range of health benefits that we might have wanted and expected. And so to still be playing out these horrific numbers mm-hmm. of 800-odd or close to 800 fatalities every single day, it's a nightmare.
Right.
I mean, it's just a nightmare. We focused a lot on whether or not the hospital system would be overwhelmed. That was, in fact, the proper emphasis, you know, and so they spent a lot of time on that. On the other hand, some of these other issues about whether or not we should have started sooner, whether or not we could have broken the back of this thing or substantially reduced it, those are real issues for other cities. And so I don't think it's something we can leave for very long. Just as you suggest, Meghna, the you know, in Houston and in Pittsburgh and in Cleveland and everywhere else, they do not want to wait. That, to me, would be one of the main messages from New York.
Yeah, I mean, and look what we have. In New York City, we've got more than 103,000 known cases of coronavirus in one city alone. Now, you mentioned schools and the decision to close down schools. It seems as if there's still some tension between Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo, because even just this weekend, there was some disagreement between the two of them about who has the authority to reopen New York City public schools and when. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, there's a longstanding, and this goes back at least, you know, 50 years, mayors and governors of New York are always at odds. You know, it was true with Nelson Rockefeller and John Lindsay, both of whom were Republicans. It was true for, you know, David Dinkins and Mario Cuomo. It's just always the case that the governor has more power than the mayor, for sure, but the mayor has kind of a flashier, more high-profile position. And so the two of them almost never get along, frankly. It just doesn't work that way. In any event, the mayor made an announcement the other day saying that the schools are going to remain closed through the end of this school year. The governor, within minutes or an hour or so later, said, it's not the mayor's call, it's my call. And I'm going to make this on a regional basis, which does make some sense, I have to point out. I mean, you know, you can't just yank New York City out of the flow of everything else that's going on around here. The reality is, school teachers, a lot of them live in the suburbs. They have kids. They have needs. There are other school systems that have to make their decisions as well. And so it does make sense to have some kind of planning and coordination. So the governor probably has substantively the better argument there. Uh-huh. It's just a little jarring for the rest of us that the mayor does a whole announcement about how the schools are going to stay closed. And then about 90 minutes later, the governor says no decision has been made.
So the lesson there for the rest of America is the continued importance of coordination between the state and local level. But Dr. Farber, let me turn back to you. I mean, from the point of view of public health right now, school systems are big systems in any American city, right? We're not just talking about students moving around. As Errol said, we're talking about teachers, support staff, you know, people who bust kids around. I mean, it's sort of like reactivating an entire part of a city. Is, you know, what would be your advice? Is it possible at all that New York should or could reopen its public schools before the end of this school year?
I think it's very, very unlikely. I mean, I think that, as you pointed out, the lessons to be learned are not to underreact to this, and if anything, overreact and then back off. And still, at this level of infections that are cropping up, I just don't think we're ready to unlock this city, as painful and as difficult and as horrible as it is. I think it needs more time.
So what signals, what data would signal the beginning of readiness to unlock New York?
A dramatic decrease in the number of new cases, tremendous increase in the number of free beds in hospitals, the mobilization of public health workers and hiring of new ones to start contact tracing, enormous expansion of testing, which is still difficult to get in New York other than for healthcare workers and hospitalized patients. Those are the and expanded serology, which is just starting to come up to see who has been infected and is asymptomatic and how much baseline immunity we now have in our population. Those are the major aspects that would allow us to make an intelligent decision.
Okay, so those you just mentioned at least four things that I could count. Those first two indicate that we can't just be satisfied with flattening the curve. Things can't be unlocked until the curve is on the way down dramatically.
Yes.
Okay. And do you see that as happening anytime soon in New York?
Well, I'm always hopeful, but I don't see that happening dramatically before June, in, you know, if that's what you're talking about.
Okay. I guess I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm hoping to hear from you, honestly, about and realistically. So June, so a couple of months. But this is sobering but real news that other cities need to hear. So Dr. Farber and Errol Lewis, hang on here for just a moment. We've got a lot more to talk about what New York City could be teaching other American cities as they cope with the COVID-19 pandemic as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be asking researchers how you quickly develop a safe and effective vaccine in the middle of a global pandemic. Obviously, we'll be talking to researchers who are seeking out a vaccine for the novel coronavirus. And we want to know what your questions are for those researchers, maybe about the timeline or about what it takes in the process of vaccine development. Or if you're a researcher currently at work on this, leave us a voicemail. That's 617-353-0683, 617-353-0683 for your questions and comments about vaccine development. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're taking a close look at New York City, the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States, and the lessons that New York has for other American cities. Let's listen to a call that we got from Ro in Brooklyn, who's taking care of her elderly parents from afar.
Hey, this is Ro from Brooklyn. I help to take care of my parents who are older in their 80s. So I'm keeping them locked indoors and doing all the shopping for them and keeping my social distancing from them also. Our local hospital here is Maimonides in Brooklyn, which has been significantly overwhelmed in days past with cases. We hope that there's an easing there soon. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
That's Ro from Brooklyn, New York. Now, we also want to hear for a moment from Governor Andrew Cuomo, who on March 30th was a voice of calm for New Yorkers, but he also made it clear that things were getting desperate quickly. We are beyond staggering, Governor Cuomo said. Again, this is March 30th. And then he went on to say this.
As governor of New York, I am asking healthcare professionals across the country, if you don't have a healthcare crisis in your community, please come help us in New York now. We need relief. We need relief for nurses who are working 12-hour shifts, one after the other after the other. We need relief for doctors. We need relief for attendants. So if you're not busy, come help us, please. And we will return the favor.
Governor Andrew Cuomo on March 30th. Now, Errol Lewis, I'm seeing some numbers here from the New York Times that said that 25,000 healthcare professionals from outside of New York answered the governor's call. But there's been a challenge in putting those people to work in New York City, in New York State hospitals. What's been going on there?
Yeah, well, look, it was a great idea. And there were some early projections that suggested literally every pair of hands that you could get would be both needed and essential. It turned out that the numbers didn't play out to the worst case scenario. And so it becomes a huge task to try and figure out how do you connect people up. Like, for one thing, somebody shows up with a medical credential from halfway across the country, that person's got to be vetted. I mean, you've got to find out, like, are they really licensed? Do they have anything in their past that you need to know about? What kind of training do they have? What system are you going to plug them into? I mean, as it is, we have public hospitals, we have private hospitals, none of which are used to working together. So that in and of itself is a big challenge. And so trying to sort of plug in all of these volunteers who showed up in New York was more difficult, I think, than probably the state realized.
Yeah. Well, Errol, hang on here for a second, because I know you probably got some other reasons why this was challenging. But since Dr. Farber is the chief of infectious diseases for Norwell Health, this is the largest healthcare provider in New York State. I mean, what in your view, Dr. Farber, what were some of the challenges of getting those volunteer healthcare professionals to work in New York hospitals?
Yeah, I agree. What we did is a major redeployment. We have not relied on healthcare workers from out of the state. We have relied on a group from the University of Rochester who has come down and helped us, who are vetted. And quite frankly, what we've mostly done is taken an enormous number of physicians, everything from orthopedic surgeons to urologists to gynecologists to dermatologists to endocrinologists, and have redeployed them, closed their practices down, and redeployed them into the hospital with supervision of infectious disease doctors and pulmonary doctors to make up for the slack. And that's predominantly what we've done.
Mm. And forgive me, I just want to correct myself. I misspoke and called it Norwell, but it's Northwell Health Hospital System. My apologies.
Yes.
On that. Now,
no problem.
Errol, there is another thing that's happening in New York City, which perhaps not many other cities have thought about just yet, because we have been focusing on the number of patients who show up in the hospital and end up being hospitalized. But many, many people are going through this illness at home, and some are dying at home. Can you tell
Yes.
us, like, are those people being accounted for?
Not necessarily. Up until now, and the mayor recently acknowledged that there are approximately, pre-coronavirus, about 20 people died at home each day in New York City. It's just the sort of the natural course of events. That number apparently has bumped up to upwards of 200 people a day are dying at home. And the obvious connection is that these are people who are dying from the coronavirus. The numbers, therefore, are a little bit questionable, and so we want to make sure that we capture them. But more to the point, there are lots and lots of New Yorkers who are scared and alone and don't know what to do. And we've seen some horror stories, frankly, of family members who have a loved one who dies at home, and they don't know what to do. They call for the medical examiner's office. Well, the medical examiner's office has been overwhelmed. In some cases, it takes 12 hours, 18 hours, 24 hours for them to send somebody to pick up the body. In the meantime, family members are worried about contamination. They're not sure what they should do. It's a mess. It's a mess. It's a real tragedy. And the city, again, has been a little slow at recognizing this and coming up with some kind of a decent plan to address it. Because up until now, the mayor has said he doesn't want to get into all of the gory details. He wants to be respectful of families that are going through a very difficult time. On the other hand, you know, this is hundreds of people every single day, and there's a need, I think, to give them some information about what it is they're supposed to do.
Well, does the city have the person power to, you know, do the medical examiner's office have the person power to go into hundreds of apartments every day to retrieve the bodies?
Well, you know, it's interesting. They have brought in professional coroners apparently there's a federal coroner's service, and they've sent some personnel up here to help out. There have been refrigerated trucks that have been parked outside many of the hospitals so that deceased patients can be stored for a while. And then there's the terrible situation of people being buried in New York City's Potter's Field, where a body that's been unclaimed normally 30 days, but they've shortened the period now to 15 days. It's placed in a temporary grave on an island here in the East River, and then family members at some point in the future can come and claim the body.
Wow.
But it's an agonizing situation for families.
So, Dr. Farber, this is going to continue to happen in New York and, sadly, in other cities. What should a family do if their loved one passes away inside their home?
Well, as he said, it's a tragedy. And unfortunately, they're at the mercy of the public health service and the city. There is nothing else they could do other than they should close the door and stay away from the body for the hours until it's picked up. And I have to just add one thing, which is we often are beginning to talk about the concept that people are dying of COVID without COVID. And although many of those deaths that are occurring in New York in people's homes every day are likely from COVID, there has also been a lack of regular medical care that would normally be given to these people. Some of them may have myocardial infarctions. New York hospitals have reported a 90%+ decrease in the number of cardiac catheterizations and interventions in people with chest pain. And there's sort of this passing joke, where have all the heart attacks gone during this outbreak? And, you know, quite frankly, we're not sure whether there are people at home suffering or whether, you know, there's going to be this enormous pent-up demand when there's a little bit more capacity in the healthcare system.
So we've just got a couple of minutes left. And Dr. Farber, I want to circle back to the initial question I asked you is like, what is the complex mix that led New York to being the epicenter right now? In a certain sense, it's New York's uniqueness, right? The most populous city in the United States, the most densely populated city, an international hub, people whose lives are in the fabric of the city, including using public transit, all that kind of stuff. What would you say to residents in other cities that say, well, we're not exactly like New York, so it's not going to be as bad here? I mean, Houston is huge, but it's geographically massive, too, so it'll be easier to keep people away from each other. I mean, it should. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What I would say is it's the virus. It's the virus. It's the virus. And yes, New York, I think, got hit a lot harder than many places. But this virus is not going to ignore any city or rural areas. And so I would suggest being as aggressive as possible and taking draconian measures early on to isolate it, to do contact tracing, to do massive testing, which we didn't have, and to try to contain it until we buy enough time, until there's a very good therapy or until there's a vaccine.
Well, and Errol, same question to you from your perspective as a City Hall reporter and watcher for so many years.
Yeah, I mean, it would be much better to have been accused of overreacting than to see what we've had, which is in some ways an underreaction. The other cities should just go all out immediately. And things like the testing protocols to make sure you know who does and does not have the virus, and then being able to sort of help contact trace everything so that you can sort of have a sense of what you're looking at, just hugely important. We had the first major outbreak in New York in a northern suburb of New York City called New Rochelle, a town that I happen to have grown up in, and it really took them sort of shutting things down, doing some contact tracing, setting up testing. They threw everything at it right away, and they kind of broke the back of the virus in that particular area. It really made a big difference.
But Errol, I thought I had read that regarding that New Rochelle case, the contact tracing may not have been actually aggressive enough in the beginning because that person was doing work in New York City as well, and then the tracing didn't go that far.
Well, the person was about as irresponsible as you could possibly be. He seems to have gone to any number of religious gatherings and then went to work and was commuting and had people drive him around, and he just sort of spread the thing every which way. The point, though, was that they could figure it out fairly quickly, and then they sort of put up some barriers. They asked people to allow their temples and their schools to be disinfected. They really went right at the virus.
Well, Errol Lewis is political anchor at NY1 News and host of NY1's Inside City Hall. It has been great to talk with you, Errol. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bruce Farber, chief of infectious diseases for the Northwell Health Hospital System. Dr. Farber, thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
Well, we're going to wrap up this hour about New York City where we started, on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Pablo Sierros co-owns a bar there called Forget Me Not. And he can't serve patrons at the bar now, of course, but he's found a way to keep his business and his neighbors going. And On Point gave Pablo a ring.
Forget Me Not. Yeah, you're looking for Paul? Just give me 1 second. He's just helping a customer. Just give me a moment.
That's all that's available right now.
We don't have vegan chocolate.
Hello? Forget Me Not, it's like, you know, it's like a local dive bar with really good food. It's mostly locals, you know. We've opened up, I think, June 8th, 2012. I think about 4 months prior to Hurricane Sandy. And that was a slap in the face right off the bat. So we made it through that. Then through a couple of blackouts, and now this. I mean, this is epic proportions, but it is what it is. What are you going to do? It's got to keep going. I was sitting with my partner, Derek, having, I think it was a whiskey. So we're thinking of what to do, and turns around and says to me, why don't we just do a grocery store? Plus, my brother owns a big supermarket in Astoria, Queens. That's where I grew up. So I figured, you know, I have the supply chain anyway. Might as well just do it, you know. So I went across the street, I got a bunch of plywood. So I brought in the lumber, and we just built the shelves, and that was it. There's definitely a Trader Joe's and a Whole Foods within 10, 15 minutes for me. But then there's huge lines. And some people just don't want to wait. They just come, get their stuff. But obviously, I can't compete with the big chains. You know what I mean? We do our best. But also, we have full liquor. They don't. We sell a lot of gin and tonics to go, Bloody Marys, margaritas, whiskeys. You know, some you can't get in a big store. You see the same faces, you know, same conversations. You know, you check on people, they check on you. You know, back and forth. You know, you choose to help people, you choose to help yourself, you choose to keep sane, you know, you choose to keep other people sane. And I think the mental health thing is going to be a huge thing after this. And at least I have the TVs, we play some old soccer games, you know, because there's no sports either, so that drives people insane. It's going to be huge, man. Listen, people have supported us through the years, like this crazy, crazy support. So we give it back as much as we can. Okay, all we have left is each other. That's it. Yeah, Derek, lady wants to pay.
That's Pablo Sierros, owner of Forget Me Not, his bar turned mini-mart in New York City. Pablo told us he also managed to get masks from his brother's store and donate them to customers, some of whom work at a hospital. And he's confident he can keep Forget Me Not afloat, and one day he sees his tables filled up again with customers. More importantly, Pablo says, he looks forward to being able to watch live soccer games again. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.